Geekscape.com. Ancient Eugenics, Part 6. The chief interest of the Aristotelian eugenics lies in the fact that he set out to construct a scheme which should be practicable for Athens. No academic speculation in the clouds, but a possible plan for social reform. The legislator must bear two things in mind: what is possible and what is proper. It is not enough to perceive what is best without being able to put it into practice. Hence careful attention is paid to popular opinion and existing custom. The consensus mundi, the collective capacity of the many, are factors the importance of which he constantly emphasizes. This divine right of things as they are, involving a certain conservatism, led him to uphold any custom revealing, after analysis, a balance of good in its favour. Hence the acceptance of infanticide and slavery and regulation of the marriage age. The doctrine of the mean, also, which helped to decide the proper disposition of parents and to fix the number of the state, was an essential article of received opinion. If Athens had ever instituted a eugenic system, it would have been the system of Aristotle, not of Sparta or Plato. Aristotle, applying the idea of development to knowledge as well as to the objects of knowledge, not only conceived his own theories as a development of those of his predecessors, but imagined himself as standing at the culmination of Greek thought. This eschatology was justified. The politics not only set the final seal upon political science in Greece, it marks also the last word in eugenics. Looking back upon these past systems, we find that the task was easier for a pre-Christian age, which could sacrifice the lower classes in the interests of the higher and solve the problems of heredity by infanticide. Even when the influence of Sparta had died away and eugenics was regarded no longer as a mere ancillary to war, parochialism confined it to a single state, inhumanity to a single class. The features which are so prominent in all these early schemes, precise limitation of the marriage age and detailed schemes of education, are features which, though still recognized, no longer have their place in the foreground of modern thought. The Greeks were concerned more with the banks of the stream. The modern aim is to control its source. The gradual process of social reform during the first three quarters of the 19th century has gradually brought us further back in the course of successive stages. From measures of sanitation and factory laws, we have passed to national schemes of education. A gradual extension of aim has led to efforts to guard the child at birth, even before birth, and finally, eugenics has set itself to solve the problems of heredity. The life history albums of Galton would trace the workings of the ancestral curse, the Aeti, of inherited disease, as well as of inherited sin. Mendelism would render possible a factorial analysis of the individual. Nevertheless, though the Greeks abandoned the question of heredity in despair, and unable to prevent its victims being born, slew them, if possible, at birth, they realized many of the problems which, 2,000 years later, are still confronting eugenicists, and they realized in part the remedies. It is wrong to say that antiquity never raised the question as to whether a hereditary disease or predisposition to disease should be a bar to marriage. The Spartans, Plato, and Aristotle all realized the problem, Plato, returning to atavism for his remedy, Aristotle conceiving the humaner methods of modern eugenicists. Sparta and Plato, too, were not blind to the need, today so urgent, of restrictive measures dealing with the insane, and Plato even dreamt of segregation. There is the recognition also that eugenics is the sphere of the physician as well as of the philosopher, that quantity is a factor in the problem as well as quality, that selective eugenics must regard the psychical as well as the physical. But even that final formulation in the pages of Aristotle, which would have been possible to the age and more possible today than the narrow scheme of Sparta or the unsubstantial visions of Plato, even these saner eugenics have in them much that is impossible, no little that is abhorrent to thinkers of today. But the idea had been given life and brought to bear. Long after the sowers had passed away, it sprang to renewed existence, in a different age and in a different form, engendered by new conditions. After Aristotle stretches a gulf of years, in which eugenics lies amidst the lumber of forgotten theory, the state education of the 4th century may have owed something to Plato and Aristotle, but there is no state control of marriage. Zeno and Chrysippus, influenced perhaps by a perverted Platonism, advocated community of wives. But Zeno taught that the intelligent man should avoid all public affairs except in a state approaching perfection. And Chrysippus, writing a treatise on the education of childhood, is reproached by Poseidonius for neglecting its first and most important stages, especially those before birth. Poseidonius blames Chrysippus and admires what Plato taught about the formation of children while yet unborn. No attempt was ever made to realize the ideals of the Republic, except by dreamers and somnambulists at second hand in an age of mysticism and social degeneration. Plotinus obtained from the Emperor Gallienus and his wife the concession of a ruined city in Campania, which had once been founded by philosophers. He proposed to restore it, name it Platonopolis, and adopt the laws of Plato. This early anticipation of the one-eider community never seems to have been realized. In the Utopia of Sir Thomas More, the marriage preliminaries, suggesting something of Plato's physical point of view, recall a passage in the Laws. But in Campanella's City of the Sun, we find a closer approximation to the Platonic eugenics. Marriage, recognized as an affair of the state rather than of the individual, because the interests of future generations are involved, is only to be performed in the light of scientific knowledge. The great master, who is a physician, aided by the chief matrons, is to supervise marriage, which will be confined to the valorous and high-spirited. There is to be a system of state education, and the women are trained for the most part, like men, in warlike and other exercises. Campanella has been called the prophet of modern eugenics. He is the connecting link between the crude eugenics of the past and the scientific eugenics of Galton. There was one brief attempt at practical eugenics, the one-eider community of noise, which, outrunning scientific knowledge and the ideas of the day, raised the bitter antagonism of a public not yet fitted to receive it. 2,000 years after Aristotle, Galton formulated the first scientific scheme of eugenics. This sudden arrest of the developing eugenic ideal after Aristotle is not difficult of explanation. Realizing only vaguely the difficulties with which modern science has encompassed the problem, the ancients might have been expected to have cherished the ideal till actual experiment revealed these incommensurable factors. With their conception of the state as an etre-moral collectif, with their recognition of law as the sum of the spiritual limits of the people, with the favourable support of the consensus mundi, which Aristotle never opposed, everything seemed opportune for its realisation. But just as a good man is crushed by a bad environment, so a social theory must wither in an unresponsive age. Eugenics is dependent upon the ethical perspective, the philosophy of egotism, le culte de soi-même, finds no appeal in a theory which looks beyond the pleasure of the individual to the interests of the future race. From Socrates to Aristotle, philosophy has striven to stem the current of political dissolution, and in philosophy we see an insurgent pessimism, an ever-growing prominence assigned to the theoretic life. The supremacy of Macedon signalized the final breakdown of Greek civilization. Aristotle, standing on the borderline, found in classic antiquity an influence sufficiently strong to place the community in the foreground as compared with the individual. After Aristotle, the tendency which had already been at work among the philosophers of the Academy and the Peripatetics completely reversed the position, turning aside from the ideal of man as an organic member of society. Philosophy concerned itself instead with the satisfaction of the ideas of the individual. In place of their old, dead principles, men required new guides. They sought and found in two directions, in Orientalism and philosophy. From Orientalism, they learned to profess complete detachment from an ephemeral world of sordid corporeal change, to contemn women and offspring, to throw aside costume, cleanliness, and all the customary decencies of life. Karma will soon be exhausted and nirvana attained. No theory of racial regeneration can flourish in such an atmosphere of inconsequent egotism. Epicureanism, with its watchword of seclusion, teaching its disciples to forego marriage and the rearing of children, can have no place for eugenics. Equally opposed is the tendency of Stoicism, which draws such a sharp distinction between what is without and what is within, that it regards the latter as alone essential, the former as altogether indifferent, which attaches no value to anything except virtuous intention, and places the highest value in being independent of everything. Such a system is not likely to concern itself with the interests of a state in which the mass of men are fools and denied every healthy endeavour. It is true that besides this tendency towards individual independence, there was a logical development of Stoicism, which recognized that man, to obtain his freedom, must live not for himself, but for society. But it was the earlier end that continued to predominate, bringing Stoicism nearer and nearer to the selfish egotism of Epicurus. It is only in a community of wise ones that a man will marry or beget children. A generation imbued with such philosophies would have as little thought of racial improvement as an age which found its guidance in the teachings of Schopenhauer and Hartmann. Moreover, cosmopolitanism, consequent on the dissolution of the city-state, not only brought individualism in its train, but let loose the inveterate pessimism of the ancients. So long as the city-state existed, the Greeks, forgetful of the golden age in the past and the inevitable cataclysm in the future, concerned themselves with the future progress of a limited race. But pessimism linked with individualism, became a living force in a despairing age, which had never developed the evolutionary conceptions of Anaximander. Men of after generations will be just as foolish and unthinking, and just as short-lived. Neither the future nor the past matters, but only the present. Sooner or later, all things will be transmuted again into the fiery substance from which they came. Individualism and belief in inevitable decadence were the two influences which effectually thwarted the growth of ancient eugenics. But this philosophy of Weltschmerz is an abandoned creed. Le temps de tristesse dogmatique est passé. Organic evolution has changed our whole perspective. We see our wills as temporary manifestations of a greater will. Our sense of time and causation has opened out to the infinite, and we are learning to subordinate the individual lot to the specific destiny. So eugenics, ruthlessly practiced in those distant ages when wild in wood the noble savage ran, rudely systematized, passed into the constitution of Sparta. The selfish creed of a warrior caste, even in the hands of Plato and Aristotle, it never lost its parochialism, and when this narrow spirit gave way before the cosmopolitanism of subsequent philosophy, individualism, isolating human effort from a world rational only to the evolutionist, effectually checked the growth of the eugenic ideal for centuries.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
And I'll just add a few thoughts of my own to the end of this narration about eugenics. There is some complaint about eugenics that every life is sacred and people should be allowed to have as many children as they wish. And that supposedly is the Christian viewpoint. Now, Adolf Hitler had a different viewpoint, and his viewpoint came from a Christian viewpoint too. He said that man was created in the image of God, and a defective man is a mockery of the image of God. So if you've got people with congenital diseases, they should not be allowed to produce children. And if they are going to produce children, then those children should be stopped before being born, so that they don't have a chance to pass that disease on to the next generations. And it's the same with people that are going to pass on diseases, that are going to, the life of the child is going to be severely limited due to the disease that they have. I'm thinking of children born with diseases that cause immense pain, or children born mentally damaged, physically damaged, with limbs missing. Children that cannot actually behave like children. These offspring should be prevented from being born in the first place. And that's not anti-Christian, because these children, though they may be loved by their parents, they're still a mockery of the image of man, and the image of man is the image of God. So to create a monstrosity instead of creating a healthy and fit human being is a blasphemy. It's a mockery of God. And it's the same with mongrelized offspring. If you have whites that mix with blacks, then I firmly believe that should be stopped before it's born, stopped before birth, because you're cursing every generation from then on to no longer be a natural creation, to no longer be born in the image that it was designed for it. And whether you believe in God or nature, we have a design, we have a form of the race that we conform to, and it was either designed by nature or designed by God. But to mix two races together means that you no longer have that natural image, you no longer have that natural form. You have an unnatural form, you become an abomination. An abomination should not be allowed to live in the first place. Now, I'm not saying we should go out and exterminate mulattoes and other mongrels, but in an ideal world, if race mixing would be completely unlawful, and if anybody was caught race mixing, if there was ever a pregnancy, then that should be stopped before there is any offspring, before there is any chance to continue contaminating the rest of the world with these abominations. You're cursing your children to do that. So eugenics, I think, conforms with Christianity. Man was made in the image of God. So man that is not in the image of God, everything possible should be done to prevent that occurring. If it does occur, then we just have to look after these people. But we have to certainly have to make sure that they don't propagate, they don't breed any more of their kind. We have to sterilize them at the very least to prevent them from producing more defective human beings. And really, this comes into the rights of a child. A child should have a right to be born into a healthy body and a healthy mind. That's what the real rights of the child are. And we don't see this anywhere. We see fetuses being murdered in the wombs as a form of contraception. And nowhere is it encouraged that people who have defective genes, have congenital deformities and genetic diseases, we don't see anywhere saying, well, they shouldn't have children. In fact, in some cases, we celebrate the fact that they've been able to have IVF children. You should not be having any children, because you're just placing a curse on the offspring. Imagine being born into a body that doesn't function right. You wouldn't know anything different. And this is the argument that these people make, that the parents of these people make. They say, well, you wouldn't know any different. But they do know different. They know that they're not the same as everyone else. And even if they don't know any different, why should they not be able to live life to the fullest extent like everyone else? Why should they not be able to go outside and play football like all the other kids of their age? Why should they not be able to go out and play like the other kids of their age? Why should they be dribbling and drooling and not capable of having a conversation with the people around them? All these basically defective human beings, there should be something in place to prevent them from being born. That's at the extreme end of the scale. At the other end of the scale, you've got the criminals. Criminality, in lots of cases, lifetime criminals, people that continue to commit crime, regardless of going to prison, you usually find that their parents were criminals, or that they have relatives that are also persistent criminals. Criminality is also heritable. People that won't stop committing crimes, they should be prevented from having children. Whether you encourage them not to have children by rewarding them for it, or whether you sterilize them. There's two different ways of doing it. And if it was socially unacceptable for alcoholics and drug users and criminals to have children, that would be a start, just to make it socially unacceptable for them to do that, so that they would be ostracized and shunned if they did. And at the same time as doing that, you could reward them for not having children. You could reward them for being sterilized. And as you've heard there, in ancient eugenics, one of the problems with these early eugenic plans was that they were going to get rid of all the lower classes. No, we need the lower classes. We do need the lower classes. We need the people that till the fields, people that clean the roads, people that do the digging, people that do the farming and the building. We need all these people just as much as we need the scientists at the top and the philosophers and the politicians and the philosophers and the thinkers and the doctors. We need all these types of people, but we need them to be of our own race. And we want them to be the best that they can possibly be. Like should breed with like. If you have a highly intelligent person, they should marry another highly intelligent person and then produce highly intelligent children. And back when, in the time of Sparta, a good physical body would also correspond with a good mental mind. If you are physically fit, you are likely to have a high IQ and be good at, a good thinker. This is why the ideal, the Greek ideals, were of beauty, because a beautiful body meant that the person would also have a beautiful mind. The two went hand in hand. And it's only through Mongolization, mixing the two, mixing the races through invasions and being forced to breed with other types, that we don't have that anymore. And all our caste systems are gone. We have no caste systems in the West. We used to have caste systems. Priests would only breed with priests. Farmers would only breed with farmers. Warriors would only breed with warrior families. And the castes would be kept separate. And you would have a sense of equality between the castes as well. Obviously, you would have kings and warriors and noblemen at the top. Then you'd have your farmers and your labourers in another part. And the labourers and the farmers, obviously, they're not going to be equal with the kings and the nobles at the top, but they would be equal with the other farmers and the labourers. And if they needed to borrow something, they could borrow it off the other farmers and the labourers. And there wouldn't be any usury put on top. But they certainly wouldn't try borrowing it from the nobles or the kings. The nobles and the kings would keep within their caste, and the farmers and the labourers would keep within their caste. And there'd be equality within that caste. But the castes themselves would not be equal. You'd have this hierarchy of importance. This is why in the Anglo-Saxon times you had wergild, and the price of a man was his wergild, and that varied due to the position of importance that the man held within the society. And in an ideal eugenic society, you would produce the amount of people that you needed from each caste, and the most successful people in that caste would be encouraged to produce the most, to have three or four offspring. And the least successful people of the caste, they're being encouraged to have one or two. Because you have to have these, you have to have the numbers, you have to have the replacement. Possibly a way to do this would be to issue marriage licenses. But the most important thing is to prevent mongrels from being born, and to prevent disabled, mentally and physically disabled children from being born. And if there are any born, they have to be prevented from increasing and producing any more. And that is basically just ensuring that the creation remains exactly as it was when it was first created. It's ensuring that God is not mocked, because a mongrel is a mockery of God's image of man. A congenitally deformed child is a mockery of God's image of man. And that's the way that we have to look at it. That's the way that I look at it. And to me, that just seems logical and sensible. And that's the way Adolf Hitler looked at it too.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.